This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the U.S. and around the world. Welcome to Baseball Outside the Box, the show that loves to interview baseball's best coaching minds who love to challenge the status quo. And we have a great show for you today. Don't forget, before we start, go to Twitter at Baseball Out. Check out YouTube, Peter Caliendo. And also the show will be live on Facebook along with our podcast, baseballoutsidethebox.com. Go there and subscribe. And listen, folks, we got a great show for you because, in my opinion, we have a future Hall of Famer, I believe, after looking at everything, man. I got to tell you, we're going to fight for this guy. First of all, we're going to talk about the Italian-American Baseball Foundation. Both of them are part of it. But let me introduce to you first, Joe Guagliano, the president of the foundation. Joe, how you doing, buddy?
Very good, Pete. Thank you for having me on and John on tonight. And it's an honor. You're a baseball legend here.
Yeah, and I wanted to save John second because we save the best for last, right? This is a guy, folks, look, 22 years in the big leagues. Are you kidding me? He's got 1,119 games he's pitched. That's a National League record. Fourth in Major League Baseball history. 424 saves. Ranks 15th all time. I mean, think about this. Yes, Brown University, and I'm going to ask John about this. He played infield. Interesting. ERA 2.89. Maybe I made a mistake. I'll blame it on Wikipedia. Four-time All-Star, two National League World League Relief Man Awards, three National League Saves Leaders. John, welcome to the show, man. You got to be in the Hall of Fame. Welcome, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate it. Let me make one thing correct. Let me correct you on one thing. I never went to Brown University. My son, JJ, went to Brown University.
And that's why I said, if I make the mistake, I admit it. But, I'm going off of Wikipedia. So I'm going to have to blame Wikipedia. And listen, for all three of us, three good Italians, as you know, my parents from Italy. I was actually raised there 3 years, speak the language fluently. Had a little espresso on you guys, so we.
I was in Italy with Joe. Joe had espresso every half hour while we were in Italy.
And that's normal. That's normal, right?
I don't know how he didn't blow up. That guy. And he slept that night too. It's unbelievable.
John, I gotta
tell
you.
The best espresso.
Best coffee in the world and best espresso in the world. John, I have an espresso every night, an hour before bedtime, and I sleep fantastic.
Wow, are you serious?
Yes.
Wow. I couldn't do that, Pete. I couldn't have espresso probably after 7 o'clock.
Yeah, but that's your 15th before 7 o'clock you have.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, John. Go ahead, Joe. Go ahead.
I need a little vino to put me to sleep after the espresso.
That sounds good. Love to have that right now. John, let me just start with you. We're going to get into the foundation, but I just want to ask you quickly, because you got, 22 years, I mean, it's incredible the career that you've had. When you look back, when you look back to your career and you say, okay, John's going to start his major league career now, but you know everything that you knew in the 22 years that you've pitched, what would you change? I'm not sure you need to change much, but what would you change possibly as a pitcher? Anything?
Probably if I'm starting right now, what I knew back then, probably try to be a little bit more consistent on, when I blew a game, I used to blow three or four in a row instead of this one. So I would try to just cut that down a little bit, but otherwise, I had a pretty good career. My fastball changeups. I wouldn't change much. I mean, I was pretty successful in what I did, but I would just have to say that when I did blow a save, it came in bunches. Two or three in a row, and then would stop it for a while. Maybe not work too many 3-2 counts.
And a lot of coaches listen to the show, not just in the U.S. but all over the world. We're fortunate to be in over 100 countries. you know, you mentioned, and I think it's important to talk about this. When you're at that level, and you do have some times where you have rough times, as you just mentioned, how did you deal with that? How'd you get back mentally? Any recommendations for young pitchers or how you dealt with that?
Well, you know, as a stopper or closer, you know, I always compare myself and stoppers as field goal kickers. You know, you could save 15, 16, 17 in a row, and a field goal kicker could make 15, 16, 17 in a row. And it's that one blown save or that one missed field goal that everybody remembers. So you just try to stay consistent. You just try to block it out. The good thing about relief pitching is if you have a bad day today, you have a chance to get in the game tomorrow. And I had some good coaches along the way. I got great advice from Jim Cott, the great pitcher. He was my pitching coach in Cincinnati. He used to put his arm around you when you had a bad day, and he'd point up to the sun and say, look, that sun came up today, and just turn the page. And that's what you have to do. You have to have the short memory on the night before, and hopefully you can get out there as quick as possible.
Hey, how about when, you know, because you had to pitch, obviously, like you said, maybe sometimes two, three times in a row. Were any routines you had the day after or after you pitched the day after to get ready for the next day, or was it just let's go again?
Well, really, no, not too many routines. I mean, there was a time, you know, back in the day when I was playing, you know, I would pitch 6-7 days in a row. Turk Wendell, who was a teammate of mine, went 9 days in a row. So things were a little bit different back then. But my routine was just basically when I first came up, I tried to strike everybody out. And then I had one of my great pitching coaches and one of my mentors, Dave Wallace, taught me that don't try to strike everybody out. Just try to throw as least amount of pitches as possible and get out of there, and then you'll be ready for the next day. So my routine was to get in and out as quick as possible. If I could throw three pitches and give up three line drives and get three outs, then I'm ready for tomorrow. I would do after a game what I would ice. I would do my weights. And the next day I come out and just play a little long toss and be ready for the night if they needed me.
Now, long career, any injuries during that time? And I asked this for a reason.
I've had a couple of injuries. Early in 1992, 93, I tore my flexor tendon in my elbow. But I didn't miss much of the season. That happened at the end of the season. So I had surgery in September. And I came back in spring training, and I was ready for the following year. And then later in my career at age 40, I had Tommy John surgery, and I missed a year and 2 weeks, and came back from that and finished my career with that. But basically, I had three elbow surgeries, flexor tendon, I had some calcium shaved off, and then I had the Tommy John surgery.
Well, what's interesting is you didn't have Tommy John until you were 40, and you were still pitching when you were 40. We got guys that having Tommy John in high school nowadays, even younger, which is a tragedy. And sometimes, unfortunately, there are parents out there that think, well, let's just have it anyway, so that way they can throw harder. I mean, it's just unbelievable when you hear those things, you know. And that's what I guess what I want to ask is this: when, because of the routine you had or because you pitched all the time, what's the difference nowadays? Why are guys getting hurt nowadays? You didn't see these injuries occur when you were pitching. You pitched 22 years.
I think there's a couple of things. You know, when the season ended, say if we didn't make the playoffs and the season ended in September, I would not pick up a baseball until the last week of January. So basically I would come home and I played football, maybe quarterback with my friends in a touch league, played basketball. I would do my weights 3 days a week, my upper body, my lower body, 2 days a week. I would run every day, do sit-ups every day, and I would have the weekends off. But I think today the players don't give their bodies enough time to rest. They take a week or two off, and then they go right back into throwing. And I think that and a lot of these new strength and conditioning coaches are coming up with these gimmicks that this do this, do that. And some of them work and some of them don't. But I think the main thing is the guys, they need to have the rest. They need to rest their arms. They do a lot of throwing during the course of the year. And I just feel that the rest is good. You know, play basketball, do something else rather than just go take a week or two off and then go right back into throwing. You're really not giving your arm, you know, your tendons, your ligaments, your muscles a chance to rest. And that was my routine. I never picked up a ball until the last week of January. And I knew I had the last week of January, 2 weeks in February to get ready for spring training. And then you had 6 weeks in spring training. By the second week in spring training, I was ready for game action. So, that's the other thing I see different. I think that guys are doing a little bit too much now to prepare for the season.
You know, I believe, and again, I'm going to say Wikipedia, so I apologize if I get it wrong. But I think you and I are about the same height, maybe 5'10 and a half, 5'11. Am I correct?
I'm about 5'10.
Yeah. And I bring this up because, you know, how many years have I heard, and, you know, oh, you got to be a certain height to be this, that, you know, to be a pitcher. But yet I look at Maddox, wasn't very tall. I look at you, you're not, there's a lot of guys, Guidry. There's so many guys that are not very tall. Is that a fallacy, or you think there's some truth that there's an advantage to be taller?
I don't think, I think it's a fallacy. I think, you know, a lot of the scouts, you know, obviously a bigger guy on a mound looks more deceiving, looks more intimidating to the hitters, you know, their arm angle and their release points are closer to the plate than a guy of my size. But you know what, if you throw hard, you know, one of the greatest pitchers and a guy in the Hall of Fame, Pedro Martinez was our size, and he threw great, great fastball. So I just think if you could pitch and you know how to pitch, and you know, what's the difference between a 95 mile an hour fastball, a guy at my size, or 95 mile an hour fastball, a guy who's 6'4", is really not much of a difference. I had better movement than most other guys, so that's what I would say.
And that's what I wanted to ask. And Joe, I'm going to get you in here in a second. I wanted to ask John your advice for pitchers or pitching coaches out there working with young kids, where to start, what to make sure they're doing right before they start doing certain things that maybe they see at the major league level. Where to start at to stay?
Especially at a young age in little league, you know, 10, 11, 12, you know, obviously stay away from the curveballs, which you see, it puts a lot of damage on the tendons and the ligaments. The tendons and ligaments aren't developed yet. Long toss is probably the best thing for your arm. It builds up arm strength and you could get some velocity from that. And as you get a little bit older into high school, I would do a lot of maybe tubing, a lot of stretching. And obviously long toss is very important from the early age all the way to the big leagues. If you ask any big league pitcher, I would say 99% of the guys long toss all the time to help stretch out the muscles, stretch out the tendons. It builds up arm strength, and it's probably the safest exercise that you can do. And the other thing you would tell the coaches, let the kids have fun. Let them play. Don't put too much pressure on them.
You know, the other area I wanted to ask was, you're talking about as a pitcher, as a relief pitcher, when you're coming into a ball game, what type of hitter, I guess, and you can mention names if you want, but what type of hitter, the actual type of hitter, gave you problems that you didn't like seeing? And how did you try to pitch to him? Obviously, maybe you didn't try to pitch to him. Maybe, you know, you put him on, but how did you deal with that?
I have three guys that were a thorn in my side. And one of them's a Hall of Fame, and obviously, unfortunately, he passed on. Tony Gwynn was a guy that I could never get out. When I was with Cincinnati, we were in the Western Division, obviously, with San Diego, and I would face Tony Gwynn, and I would pitch him a pitch inside, and he hit a base hit to right, pitch him away, base hit to left, up, you know, pitch him down the middle, base hit up the middle, and finally, I just said, you know what, I'm going to throw it down the middle, and I hope that he hits a line drive right at somebody. And when Tony retired, they had a statistic up on ESPN that the top five averages, I believe, that he had against pitches, and it was myself, Maddox, Glavin. I forgot the other two pitches, but I felt that was in pretty good company with Glavin and Maddox. The other two guys, yeah. Mariano Duncan, who was with the Reds and the Phillies and the Yankees and the Dodgers, and a guy who played for the Chicago Cubs earlier in my career was Bob Dinier, center fielder for the Cubs. Those type of Duncan, the guy, contact hitters, the guys who were contact hitters were the guy, those three guys, they're all contact hitters. They gave me the most problems. The home run hitters, the long ball hitters, I had no problem with them. I'd rather face, you know, a Bonds, a Mike Schmidt, a home run guy rather than the contact hitters in a big situation.
You know, and this is a great segue because I want to bring Joe in with the president of the Italian American Baseball Foundation. And, you know, I want to bring in the question about nowadays, what you guys think about today's game when it comes to some of the rules that you're seeing. You know, they're trying to implement certain rules. Internationally, I'm very familiar with the man on second rule because we had to use it in the Olympics. But there was a reason we had to use it in the Olympics, or we weren't going to get in the Olympics because they weren't allowing us, you know, to have that much time. And that was an issue. So that was one of the reasons we had to deal with that. But even the pitching rules, I'll let Joe start. Joe, what do you think about some of the rules that we've seen in baseball? What do you like, what you don't like, and why maybe?
Well, the pitching rule, the three batter limit, I don't like at all. I don't think it's good for the game. It changes the whole dynamics of the bullpen, and it puts the manager in a difficult position to make changes when needed. And I'm not a big fan of that that rule. And hopefully next year they do something about changing that. I don't know, John, how do you feel about that?
John, on that, you had to pitch to all type of hitters. I mean, you were basically the same, that pitcher. Right. Nowadays, you almost need a bunch of those guys because you don't know when you're going to go in.
Right. I'm not a big fan of the three batter rule also. I think I agree with Joe. It takes away from the game. It takes away the strategy of the game, the cat and mouse game between the manager, the home team, and the visiting team. You know, when they say it speeds up the game, I really don't see it speeding up the game. You know, if the umpires would call a little bit more strikes.
It doesn't speed it up.
Yeah. If the umpire called more strikes, maybe that would speed up the game. I'm not a big fan of the guy on second base. You know, extra innings and have the guy on second base. I think that's more or less high school tournaments that you go around to, something like that. And also, I would like to see them implement when they do the shifts, they play the shifts, maybe you're allowed maybe two or three shifts a game, and that's it. I think the right. shift has gone so overboard with the analytics and the sabermetric stuff that I think it's the sabermetric stuff is good to a certain extent, but I think the shifting of the players, back in the day, you guys probably remember the only shift I remember was the McCovey shift when Willie McCovey used to.
McCovey shift, that's right.
San Francisco, right? Because everybody knew Willie McCovey shifted, pulled the ball. But those are the three things. And obviously, I would like to see them not put the DH in the National League. I think that also is the strategy of the game where you have your 8 and 9 hitters, usually your weaker hitters, where the pitcher has to bunt. You know, I'm a little old school in that way where they sacrifice, hit and run, stuff like that. But those rules aren't the rules that they haven't changed those rules yet. But the three rules that I said, the shifts, the three pitching rule, and the man on second base, I'm not too crazy about that.
Yeah, and hang tight, folks, because one of the rules, which I don't get at all, that they're thinking about, and because they want to see more stealing, now they want pitchers to possibly step off before they pick off. They want to implement more stealing. I mean, I'm thinking, well, why can't we just teach people how to steal, steal the bases better? But here's the part I want to ask. The game itself, I mean, I'm a little disappointed because I'm watching a game. I'm seeing a lot of strikeouts. And, okay, we do get the home runs, and those are exciting. But we don't see what John just mentioned, the bunting, the stealing, the hit and running. And I know certain things you can't do, John, because they can really play catch in the big leagues. I mean, these guys could catch and throw. They got great talent. So it does diminish it a little bit where you maybe couldn't – statistically, you can't do certain things. But, man, don't we want a more exciting game?
John, I'll let you handle that one, and I'll follow up with it.
Well, the home runs are a big part of – making the game exciting. And I think part of the marketing is the home run part of it too, because it brings kids to the stadium. And I think Major League wants to see that, the home run hitters. But this year, I'll tell you, the home runs being hit so far, I've never seen the ball travel so far. I don't know what to make of that. I really don't know what to make of that. I mean, guys are hitting him on the third deck in the outfield there, and it's unbelievable. So I don't know. I'm not going to say the ball is juiced or anything, but the whole idea of getting people into the stands, I think, has a lot to do with home runs. The thing about the stealing that you mentioned, Pete, I haven't heard that yet, but let's hope they don't implement something like that.
Well, they're looking
that
at.
That would be just, I mean, that's just crazy. That's just nuts. And, it's like John said before, the sabermetrics and the people running the game, I don't know if they ever played the game, really. I think they're just a lot of Harvard graduates that are making the decisions now. And you see what happened in the World Series where Cash took out the pitcher, and it was a big mistake. And this is part of what the problem is with the game, I believe.
Hey, John, you ever have a manager come out and you told him you didn't want to come out?
No, I never told the manager I didn't want to. I mean, if a manager came out and said you're coming out of the game, I would never, that's the manager's decision to do that. You might have a discussion in the dugout or after the game or ask him why he took you out. but I would never show up a manager or talk to him on the mound like that. Why are you taking me out? Those are all discussions that you would want to have behind the closed doors.
How about the pitching up and down? You seem to be more pitching up high and low rather than in and out. What do you think about that? And is that because of today's swing?
I think so. Yeah, there's, you know, a lot of the players have that uppercut swing now, the launch angle, what they call it right now. But you know, most of the successful pitchers are the guys who are up and down and also in and out. You know, so guys who go north and south and east and west, those are the guys who've been successful. And you know, the hitters are so good. You know, like Joe said, these guys hit balls a mile and a half. The hitters are so good. I don't care how hard you throw. You could throw 100 miles an hour. These guys are going to hit it. So the thing that the art of pitching, you know, when the Maddoxes and the Glavins and the guys who used to hit spots here and there, that kind of has gone away a little bit from the inside out. And it's more gone up and down, like you said, Pete. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot more home runs, because the guys are missing their spots and they're working more of the middle of the plate rather than left to right, you know, east to west.
Joe, I wanted to ask you about the Italian Baseball Foundation, but Italian American Baseball Foundation. But I want to, before we do, because you guys do a lot of camps in the U.S. and also in Italy. And before we get into the actual foundation, I wanted to ask you guys about, you know, to me, youth baseball is so important. I've been in it 37 years, and I feel that that's where everything begins and that's where everything ends, because kids quit the game if they're not having fun at that level. They're never going to play the game long term. And a goal of all of us as coaches, we want to play the game, try to get kids to play as long as possible, right? So if they're having fun. Are both you guys, and start with Joe, what's your recommendation? What should we be doing different at the younger levels, whether it's travel ball or whether it's in-house leagues? What should we be doing different instead of always the status quo of the same thing over and over? Because we're seeing kids quit the game. I don't care what anybody says. The statistics show it, that they quit at around 12 years old. And it has to do a lot of it with coaching. But go ahead, Joe. Give us some ideas. What do you think?
Pete, you hit it on the nose. If the kids are not having fun, they're not going to play. They're not going to come back year after year and play baseball. They got to have fun. And sometimes there's too much pressure on the kids. Could be from the coaches, could be from the parents. And they, you know, they want their kid to be successful and take it to the next level, but not many kids do that. So, but if they have fun, they're going to come back. And what I see is a lot, you know, go to Little League games and you see the parents yelling at the umpires, and that just puts more pressure on the kids, I believe. And, you know, when we went to Italy, we seen kids whose parents did not, I don't want to say interfere, but didn't go to the level that the parents in the States did. They sat back and they watched their kids play. And maybe because the game is not as important to them in Italy, I don't know. But
or, the kids or, played. Or maybe they don't know enough about the game. Remember when soccer first came over here to the U.S., nobody would say much.
That's right.
Be quiet.
Exactly true, Pete. And someone had mentioned to me, I said, you know, in Italy, I don't remember who I talked to, but I said, why is the game not as popular here? Because it's hard for the parents to get their kids involved in the game. Because, you know, to play baseball, you need a bat, a glove, and cleats, and you're starting out, you know, $400 or $500. But in Italy, if you have a soccer ball for $30, $40, you could go play. So the parents say, you know, go play soccer instead of baseball, because, you know, it's cheaper on the family. And that's the reason that someone told me why kids are not too involved in baseball in Italy. But the passion kids that we seen play was unbelievable. I mean, they love the game. They're out there in 90 degree heat, and they couldn't get enough of us when we went over there. John went there. He was phenomenal with the kids. And we did clinics in Rome and Nettuno and Salerno. And what we've seen, the passion is there. It's just that they don't have funds available to them to keep a good league going, a good system going. And the other thing, and we talked about this with John, is that they lack good coaching. And without good coaching, kids are not going to make it to the next level. And that's one of the big things that we've seen on both our trips to Italy so far.
Hey, John, when you were a young kid pitching, whether it be in Little League or high school, what did you want out of your coach?
I had some great coaches in travel ball. first of all, their coach made it fun. He didn't put that much pressure on us. He said, you know, win, lose, and draw. As long as you could look at yourself in the mirror and you gave it your best, that's all he asked for. Hustle. Don't, you know, run on the field, run off the field. And that's the one thing I always taught my son, JJ, when he played since he's 10 years old and he understood. You be the first one on the field and first one off the field. Whether you strike out four times or get four hits, you be the first one on the field, off the field. But I think going back to your question before, why we're losing a lot of kids, I think number one, like Joe said, everybody wants their kids to be the next Derek Jeter, the next Aaron Judge, the next David Wright. You know, not everybody's going to be like that. But the goal should be, I say, is if you Little League have a coach who teaches and have fun. You know, every coach, winning's about everything. That's all they care about, winning. Somebody has to lose. So you have to teach them how to be good losers along with good winners, number one. Number two is you have to have the kids have fun. When you're coaching, you can't be so rigid while you're coaching. You have to have the kids have fun. Have fun with the kids. Let them enjoy the game. And number three is if a kid can be successful and as a high school coach and as a travel ball coach, and travel ball could be really, really expensive. But as a travel ball coach and a high school coach, your number one goal should be try to get the kid into a college where he can play college ball and maybe get a great education out of that college. You know, the four-year school, whether it's an Ivy League school or whether it's an LSU or whether it's a Division III school that has some great baseball programs. If you can get a kid into a college, that's a step in the right direction. Anything after that, a major plus. If they get drafted and they go to the minor leagues, that's a plus that the kid deserves because he put in all that hard work. But I think one of the main things is to have fun, let the kids go out there. You know, you want to go to tournaments, you want to win, and you want to win all the time, but, you know, somebody's got to lose. But just let the kids have fun. There's just too much pressure right now on winning. There's too much emphasis on winning, winning, winning.
Absolutely. And speaking about the game, yep. John, when you were young, did you practice more or did you play more games in a year?
Well, you know, the kids now, I mean, they play 120, 130 games, you know,
that's
back
when, bringing up.
Yeah. When I was playing, you know, we played Little League, you know, from April to August, and then, you know, the All-Stars and all that stuff, that was it. You know, now I see, you know, especially here in the city where I live, the Little League starts in April and they're done in early June, and you don't see no games here, especially in Manhattan, in July and August. In the other boroughs, you know, in Brooklyn and Queens and Staten Island, I think they continue to keep going. You know, I might have played, if I played 35, 40 games as a kid in a league, that was a lot. But I grew up in a housing project where I had 10 to 14 friends, and we played ball every day in front of the building. You know, we play for hours until it was time to eat. And whether it was baseball season, football season, basketball, hockey, we played roller derby. We played whatever season it was. That's what we did, all 14. And that's the way you get better. And I have an older brother who's 5 years older than me, and I always used to play ball with him or against him, and he would always make me win up until the end and then beat me. And that made me my desire to win and want to prove to beat him even more. So that was my goal, is to always try to beat my older brother. And you know, you have that, it's fun doing that. And it's just too much, too many. They play a lot of games, 120, 130 games sometimes.
Yeah. In reference to what you were talking about earlier too, with the injuries, you know, you just said it, you did all kinds of different things, rollerblade, you know, played baseball. Were you a multi-sport athlete even in high school and in younger, when you were younger?
I played a little football in high school until I got I was on the kickoff squad and I got speared in the ribs. And I remember my dad telling me, he said, are you going to be a football player or a baseball player? You're not going to grow to be 6'4". I said, I think I'm going to play baseball. I got a better chance of playing baseball. You know, football is a tough sport to play. I enjoyed it, but I'm glad I made the right decision.
You know, and that's what we're seeing, Joe. I mean, we're seeing in the game, we're, you know, fortunately, you know, unfortunately for the pandemic, but fortunately, like here in Chicago, I was riding my bike, you know, when it's good weather. And I actually saw for the first time in I don't know how many years, kids on their own at the park playing against the wall, you know, throwing the ball against the wall and having their own game, just doing their own thing. We don't see enough of that.
I don't see it at all. I don't see it anymore. I can't tell you the last time I see it. Once in a while, by the park by my house, I'll see a father with a son you know, throwing some pitches to them. But you don't see the kids gathered together anymore playing in the park or schoolyard. I don't see it. And like John said, we used to play for hours and hours when we were kids.
We used to play stickball. You know, stickball, you used to pitch.
Stickball,
I used to play a pitch in high school and strike out 13, 14 guys in a game, throw 120 pitches, whatever. And then an hour and a half, 2 hours later, I'd be home playing stickball with my buddies in the projects, you know, with the box on the wall. You build up your arm strength, you know. There was a pitch count back then.
Well, and actually, that's why I really believe that, you know, playing 100 games when you're 10 years old. I mean, we have travel teams in Chicago. They start at 8 years old. You know, I mean, talk about burnout. After a while, no wonder kids are quitting.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a at a young age.
How do you go about changing this? How do you change it?
Well, that's a good question. You got to take over the league and obviously change the rules. You know how it is. That comes from top down, and unfortunately, Major League Baseball is trying to do their best when it comes to promoting the game at the youth level. But the key is what you guys talked about. That's the education of the coaches and parents. You know, I always thought it was a three-pronged system where you have to educate the coach, the parent, the player, and understanding something we just said, like pitch counts. You know, we didn't have pitch counts when I was younger either. Now you need them because kids are being overpitched and they're playing too many games all year round in a lot of places. Yeah. Even in Chicago, we got 100 and some games sometimes for young kids, even with the weather.
Yeah.
You're right. And think about it. It's cold right now in New York where we are in Chicago. What about the kids in Florida and Texas and Arizona and California? I mean, they play 12 months a year. They don't stop.
Absolutely. And hey, that's one of the things now that a lot of scouts are drafting kids from the Northeast because they're not playing as much ball and they're
on
cold weather cities that they're not playing as much and they still have a lot left in their arms.
Yeah. And the other part I was thinking about was, and John, there's a lot of showcases out there and I get it. Showcases is a purpose for everything. And the game's changing, times are changing, but you know, when you're holding a showcase in Florida in December and Major League Baseball scouts are there and college coaches are there. Now you got East Coast, Midwest kids going down. They're not ready for that. And you say, well, they're not going to throw that hard. Oh, really? When they put the radar gun, they're going to throw. So unfortunately, I do blame a little bit of MLB and the NCAA, because if they wanted to reduce some injuries, one way to do it is not hold those events in the wrong times, maybe hold them in better times. Because if the scouts aren't there and the college coaches aren't there, nobody's going.
Yeah, I agree. The showcases are a big money business. And like you said, when you have kids from the East Coast or the cold weather cities going down to Florida in December and going to these showcases when they haven't picked up a ball for a couple of months, that could be a lot of injuries. Again, you know, the parents, they want their kid. They don't want their kids to fall behind. They want the kids to be just like the little Jimmy down the block. He went there, and they don't want the kids to miss out on anything. You know, you have to pick and choose your showcases. There are a lot of showcases that you don't have to pay for. You know, Major League Baseball runs some showcases. Some Ivy Leagues run some showcases. You know, the college coaches can go to these showcases, but they can't talk to the kids. The colleges have showcases along sometime during the summer or like it may at the end of the college season in June, July, where they can start seeing these guys. So you have to do your homework and look around to see what showcases are around. You know, like I said before, it's a big business now. And you know, it costs you $600 just to get into the showcase. Then you got to get airfare, hotel for 3 days. The kid goes down to these showcases. He gets 15 ground balls, 15 swings. And they test his arm speed and you run the 60-yard dash and you play two or three games and you go home and they evaluate you in those three games. It's unfair to evaluate a kid in three games. You can't really tell how good a kid is in three games where you could see him in maybe 15 to 20 games during the course of the year.
Why do you think showcases became so popular as opposed to a college recruiter going to check high school kids out during the games and actually see a 9-inning game?
Well,
showcases become the thing for colleges?
It's easier because a lot of colleges don't have the funds to send their recruiters to certain cities. So these showcases have the kids and they take video of these kids and the kid could take the video and send it to Alabama, and they could send it to Southern California, and they could send it to the coaches there where they don't have to come to Myrtle Beach to watch the showcase. They could see it on a disc, and that's how they could see that. That's how they evaluate the kids.
It's really become a big business now. Yes. It really has.
And Joe, that's the reason I asked John some questions about, you know, was he a multi-sport athlete? How many games did he play when he was young? Certain questions, because, you know, parents listen to the show. And here's a guy, 5'10", you said, and yes, left-handed, but he didn't play that many games when he was young. You know, they played on their own. And it just shows, here's a guy that's going to be a future Hall of Famer that didn't have to play 100 games to play. Now, I'll give you an example. I've been to Cuba. I've been to Dominican. Some of the, you know, Latin countries, yeah, they play a lot of games. Why? Because the weather's better, right? Because just like the Florida. But nobody understands this part. They practice twice as much as they play.
That's right.
And it's a lot of credit to them, the kids in Cuba and the Dominican Republic and Venezuela. That's their way of getting off their island. That's their way to supporting their families. So if they're successful and they can get scouted and make some money to take care of their families in the Dominican Republic, that money goes a long way for those kids and those families there.
Yep. Joe, let's jump into it, because I know time's limit here. And I really appreciate you guys' time. Let's get into the foundation, man. You guys have done a great job. And let's start with a little background on the foundation. I also want to get into the gala too.
Okay, well, we started the foundation in 2016. That's Carmine Gagnon, who's a great friend of mine, along with Frank Catoinato, who played 13 years in MLB. We decided to start this foundation because we're at Frank's golf outing, and we're talking about all the great Italian baseball players in Major League Baseball. And then we said, how many of these players were born in Italy? And we looked at each other, and we couldn't come up with none of them that were born in Italy. There might have been. I know Alex Liddy played in
Liddy's the only one in the big league
for Seattle, but there hasn't been many.
No.
So we kind of figure out why if the great John guys like John and Anthony Rizzo, if these guys who are of Italian heritage are some of the best ball players in Major League history, why are they not born in Italy? Guys from Dominican come here, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Mexico, even Australia, we had a couple guys. So, you know, we decided, you know, let's go to Italy. Let's look at some of the talent. Let's talk to a lot of people. We're a very good relationship with the Federation over there, Marco Landi and Andrea Marcone. And they've took us under their wing, and they sent us to different cities to do clinics. We've been from Sicily to Tuscany, and we planned on going more north to Parma and Milan, Brescia this year. But of course, the virus wiped that out. But, you know, it's interesting seeing the talent level in Italy and the enthusiasm by these kids. As I said before, you know, they're very much into it, but they lack good coaching. And that's something that the IABF, that we want to help. We want to bring better coaches. We want to bring guys like John and Mike Pagarillo, who went with us, Mark Cardillo. And we want to go over there and help teach the game to these kids. Well, we're doing it on a very small level now, but we want it on a much bigger level next few years. So we have a lot of work cut out, but we're going to get there.
And John, you joined. Give us a background. Why? What got you interested in joining the foundation?
Well, just like the piggyback off of Joe, you know, there's so many great Italian American that played the game, you know, before us. You know, Joe DiMaggio, you know, that's the all-time great, right? We've had so many good Italian American, Mike Piazza, you know, John Franco, Frank Catalano, or Anthony Rizzo. I'm sure I'm missing a whole bunch.
There's a ton. You're right.
Right. But we don't, you know, just like what Joe said, when we went to Italy, we saw these kids. And the difference between the kids from Italy and the difference between the kids in Dominican Republic is the kids in Dominican Republic play every day. Italy, they play every three days a week. Mm-hmm. And their parents aren't into it as much. Right. And the other thing is the facilities that we saw are you know, you got to give these kids a lot of credit, because ground balls, you need an armor suit to catch a ground ball over there. And it was really, some of the fields were really, really in bad shape. So we went over there, we try to help them out as much as we can, talk to the coaches, teach the coaches what we know. And also, if our goal was to try to bring maybe one or two, maybe three kids from Italy who are ready for college and get them into a good college. And then maybe they'll get scouted and then get to the big leagues. So I got involved because I'm totally on board with Joe and Carmine and Frank, what they wanted to do. And being an Italian American, you always want to try to help out your heritage and go back to Italy to see the old country and have fun, meet great people in Italy. But just to try to instill our game in Italy, teach them, bring baseball, I believe Nettuno, where we were, they love baseball. That's a baseball town. We didn't know I didn't know that when we went there, it was a World War II, I believe, when the Germany and the Americans came there and they taught the Italians how to play ball there.
Right.
Yeah. So it was just great going over there and seeing all that history. But we want to teach them the game and teach them the right way to play and the way they play here in the United States.
Awesome. Yeah.
And agrees.
Hey, folks, in case you hear a dog bark, I love dogs.
That's my dog, Teddy. Come on, Teddy.
Hey, it's dog day.
Teddy.
Podcast show. We want to see him.
I'm going to get Teddy.
There you go. Let's see Teddy. There you go.
Our dog's very similar.
Teddy's my second baseman.
Love him. Look at that. Folks love dogs. Hey, Joe, on top of that, I was thinking, I remember to answer your question early on in the 70s, because I was there in the 70s, started that early. Lasorda had gone there and Bianchi was a catcher, I believe. And Lasorda wanted to bring him to the States. And in those days, Italian kids, man, they weren't leaving their home. They weren't leaving their family. They didn't. And they knew what Major League Baseball was, obviously, because you had guys playing there from the big leagues, playing in the pro league back then. But they didn't want to leave, and that's something, because they're more family oriented. It's a little harder to pull them away from there. Yeah. Now it's a little easier because they've been part of the classic, they're seen more. And I know you guys, you want to get kids in the States playing because there's some good players that can play college baseball, Joe, here in the States.
That's right. Pete, what was the game like when you were in Italy in the 70s?
Well, it was a big difference. In the 70s, first of all, the Lenny Randle was the top star there, hitting like, I want to say he was hitting like 700, I think. Lenny Randle is a legend there. And I remember because we used to be able to watch it on TV there in the mornings. But the fans in those days, they had rules where you could have 3-4 Americans. I think 7 at the most. I can't remember off the top of my head. But they loved American players, and the fans came out. I could see 5,000 to 6,000 fans at a ballgame in those days.
I had heard that they got 5,000 or 6,000 people to the games in the 70s.
Yeah, you could.
What happened? Because not enough. What happened to the fan base? I don't see it there anymore.
Well, they started changing the rules a little bit because, as you said, it costs a lot of money, to operate a club there. I mean, not only their top level costs money, but also the young kids. And so at the top level, what happened was the Americans were asking for more money, and that's normal, right? Because we're used to making more money playing ball. Well, so now all of a sudden now they're looking at Cuba and the Dominican and Venezuela and saying, hey, these guys are playing for a third of the money and they're just as good. So they started that avenue. But the Italians really were, think about it. Baseball came there, like John said, in the World War when the Americans barked at Anzio. That's when the game started and the Americans weren't started it. So they loved the Americans. And that's who they wanted to see. I think that was part of what we saw, the downgrade of the game there when it came to attendance, when they started getting some of the American players.
Yeah. The players don't get paid in Italy. If they do, it's not much.
No,
I think that's,
it's hard.
It stops people from going over there, Americans from playing there. They go there just for the experience.
When you only play 3 days a week, I believe they only play 3 days a week now.
That's on weekends.
Yeah, just on weekends, right?
So, weekends.
And, I remember, guys, the coaches, American coaches going there. I used to tell them all the time, listen, when you go there, because I coach there, don't show up with a practice schedule all ready to go. And like, you're going to have 15, 20 players there because you might have 8 one day, you might have 12 the other. Because school is important. There's other things that are important. Some guys were working, so you just, if you weren't used to that, if you're a typical college coach in the States where everything's, boom, boom, boom on time, that's not going to be the same there. And you can't get rid of a player because you're not going to have any backup player either, right? You get rid of your shortstop. Who's going to play? You don't have a second shortstop.
When we were there this couple of years ago, they had a kid 16 or 15. He was a teammate with a guy who was 30 years old. So that they were on the same team. Yeah.
And that's a great point, John, because, and Joe, when I was young, I was 15 playing with 22-year-olds at a baseball school. Nowadays, we want to pigeonhole kids. If you're 13, you can only play with 13.
Right.
I think it's a mistake because I think you learn a lot. John, I think you mentioned you were playing with older guys when you were younger.
Yes, I always played up. I always played up. You know, when I was 8, I was playing against 10-year-olds. When I was 10, I was playing against 12-year-olds. And my dad.
That's how you improve.
Yeah, that's how you get better. You know, you struggle a little bit because the guy's a little bit older and stronger, but you get better and better when you play against better competition.
Absolutely. Joe, talk about the gala because that's tomorrow night and I want to be on
there
and we want to get others on there too.
Yeah, tomorrow night is our, unfortunately, because of the virus, we can't have our in-person gala. And last year was a phenomenal event. But this year we're going virtual. We're going to be on Facebook Live at the Italian American Baseball Foundation Facebook page. And we're going to honor one of our members who's been with us from day one is Lee Mazzilli, former Met and Yankee. And great guy. And we're going to have the hitting coach from the Chicago Cubs, Anthony Iapoche, is going to be our achievement award recipient.
Good friend here in Chicago.
Chicago boy. Well, he's from Long Island.
Yeah, I meant he's Chicago Cubs.
Chicago Cubs, yep. And J.P. Ricciardi, former Toronto Blue Jay GM and assistant Met. He might be coming back to the Mets. It's going to be our executive award recipient. And we got some special guests coming on with us. Joe Girardi is going to introduce Lee Mazzilli. Yeah. And Joe's, we honored him last year, and he's he wants to get involved with the foundation as well. And, you know, he's got a job that keeps him busy right now. So hopefully someday in the future, he'll get more involved. And
Joe,
Gary,
a lot of people join on so they can watch it.
Just go to the Italian American Baseball Foundation Facebook page.
Perfect.
Yep.
That's tomorrow night, 8 o'clock Eastern time.
8 o'clock Eastern time. Yep. Hopefully everything goes off well. You know, with this virtual stuff, you just don't know.
That's all right. It's always a learning experience for
Pete,
all of us.
Pete, I have to tell you that, you know, since I've been involved, and you know, I'm sure Joe doesn't want to hear this, but I'm going to say for Joe and Carmine, they've done a great job promoting this thing. It started out real small in 2016, and this thing, this foundation has grown so much, and it's a credit to Joe's hard work and Carmine's hard work, putting everything together, putting a board together, putting the right people in the right spot, and honoring the right Italian Americans year in and year out. So Joe and Carmine do a fabulous job, along with the other board members, and it's just a pleasure to work with them year in and year out.
Awesome.
Well, when you put people with the name of Franco and Mazzilli on your board, it makes our job a lot easier because those names are recognized throughout the world of baseball, and people see if these guys are involved, I want to get involved.
And, if you go to the Italian American Baseball Foundation and you check out their website, check out all the people involved. I mean, they've given some names, but there's so many of them. I mean, we're talking about the Italian Baseball Federation too. What a great connection that is. I got to tell you, because I worked, when I was 21 years old, I worked for the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame. George Randazzo passed
George
away.
George Randazzo.
Years ago. Yeah. I worked for George. And now Ron Onesti, who's a very good friend of mine, is now the president. And then Joe, I want to put you guys in touch because
please,
I think that's another good connection. He mentioned it to me, and I think that'd be another good connection. John, are you in the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame?
Yes, I was honored years ago. Yes, it was a great, great night, a great event. The guys do a great job there in Chicago. Had a lot of fun out there. It's just a first-class run operation, that's for sure.
It was. George Randazzo did a phenomenal job.
Yeah, Wayne Randazzo is our MC.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wayne has been our MC since day one, 2016.
Is he, Wayne, I've met a few times, voice of the Mets, right? No?
That's right, Mets Radio.
That's radio, Chicago kid, great kid. I like that guy. The other part, hey, Joe, I'm going to put a little pressure on you. throw you a little curveball here. What are we going to do to get, how does this work with, to get John, you know, nominated for the Hall of Fame? You know, are we doing some kind of push here in the Italian community, or what are we up to here?
I don't know. I mean, why give a push? This guy should be in the Hall of Fame. He should be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, the numbers are there.
Wait a second. Joe, Ron Santo should have been in the Hall of Fame too a long time ago when he was alive, and that didn't happen either till after he passed away. I know I put you on the spot, but we could think about that. We'll get the Italian American Sports Hall of Fame involved also. A lot of good. Got to be a little political. Yeah.
I agree. Because John should be in the Hall of Fame. And like I said, the numbers are there. Some of his numbers are better than some of the other relievers in the Hall of Fame right now.
Wow. So. I mean, all time, fourth all time saves. You know, that's an incredible record. And 22 years.
Number one lefty in the history of the game.
Number one lefty. Yeah.
I mean, think about it. I mean, 22 years. I mean, you're not going to see many pitchers nowadays pitching 22 years. I don't think anybody's going to go that long. It's an incredible statistic. Listen, the other thing is, I know you guys have been great to be on this long. Joe, the foundation, is there anything else you want to talk about the foundation? And then I'll close it off unless anything you guys want to say.
Well, like I said, we hope to get back on track next year and get back to Italy. Hopefully this virus is gone and forgotten about. And we want to keep moving forward with our mission, you know, and that is to bridge baseball between the United States and Italy and help the kids in Italy and do some stuff for the kids here in the States as well. We put on a lot of clinics in the New York, Long Island area, and we want to continue doing that. And, you know, the foundation is getting stronger. We're getting more people involved. And if anyone wants to get involved with our foundation, go to our website, www.iabf.foundation, and you'll see what we do, what we're about.
John, anything?
Yeah, well, I would like to say, you know, for all your everyone who's watching tonight, if there's any corporations, any businesses that Italian American businesses, or even Italian businesses that are watching, if they would love to get involved and be a sponsor for us, that would be great. We're looking for sponsors every year to someone to come in and help us out. You know, if we can get a couple of sponsors and we can fly some kids in from Italy to be seen here, that's a big plus and a big help for us.
It is. Our trips to Italy, our equipment donations to Italy, and putting kids in college is a big expense for us. So any help we get financially is a blessing.
And we're going to put a lot of stuff on our show notes. We're going to put it all over our social media so more people hopefully get to know the foundation. All right, last thing, guys, to our parents, players, and coaches around the world, just any last-minute advice when it comes to the game. You all mentioned it, have fun, make sure they're doing certain things. But any just last-minute advice, Joe, that you want to give to our folks out there?
Pete, anything other than have fun, that is, to me, the most important thing. You know, let the kids play. If you're a coach, let the kids play. If you're a parent, let the kids play. Support them, but let them have fun. And that's what I see as the biggest problem that I see anyway.
John, any last minute words?
Yeah, just a couple of things. One is education. I think the parents should really push their kids to do well in school because not everybody's going to be a major league player. You know, if you use your brain, that could take you a long way. And like I said before, have fun. Make sure you have the right coaches who want to teach, not just to win. And just go out there, and you never know what you can see. You never know who's looking and who's watching. Always hustle on the field and off the field.
Awesome. What a great way to end it with Joe Guagliano, the president, co-founder of the Italian American Baseball Foundation, and 22-year major leaguer John Franco, hopefully a Hall of Famer soon. Guys, thanks so much. I'm going to start with Joel. Thanks so much for being on the show, man. I really appreciate it, and it was great meeting you guys.
Pete, thank you so much, and thank you for everything you do for international baseball since the 70s, so maybe before. I'm not sure. But you do a great job. Phenomenal.
Thank you, Joe, and thanks, John. I really appreciate it. Look forward to meeting both you guys, hopefully when this virus is over.
Yes, thanks for having me, Pete, and keep up the great work. Keep up the great work for all us Italian Americans.
All right, sounds good. Three Italian Americans. Remember, normally I've had shows with one Italian American. I've always said it's an Italian American show. Today we had three good Italian Americans. Folks, thanks for joining us in the U.S. and around the world. This is Baseball Outside the Box. Don't forget, check us out on Facebook. Also, check us out at YouTube at Peter Caliendo, the podcast, Baseball Outside the Box. Everybody, stay safe, stay healthy. God bless you. You'll be on the field soon, and we'll see you somewhere in the international baseball. Bye-bye, everybody.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.